Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In 1800, the fields of Jamaica bore plentiful harvests of cotton, tobacco, and sugarcane. But white colonists were outnumbered by black slaves 33-1, and Jamaica also burned with the fire of revolt. A new novel of that time by Jamaican writer Marlon James tells a story of bondage and women in revolt in Jamaica. This hour on Point, The Book of Night Women. You can join the conversation, what do you know of life in Jamaica in the heart of its slavery years, about the role of women. Marlon James joins me now in the studio. He was born in Kingston, Jamaica in 1970, won critical praise for his first novel, John Crow's Devil. He teaches now at McAllister College in St. Paul. His powerful new novel is The Book of Night Women. The New York Times calls it beautifully written and devastating. The Chicago Tribune calls it a bright dream of hell painted with a brush dipped in blood. Marlon James, welcome.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
A brush dipped in blood. Wow. This is strong. Mm-hmm. It's written in a kind of patois or pidgin English of that time.
Right.
It's very quickly, entirely readable, but it's not exactly standard English, so it flows within about 3 minutes.
Yeah.
Very easily. How did you come up with that?
It took a while. The actual novel started in, I started writing in standard English. Mm-hmm. In very sort of, you know, proper Jane Austen kind of English. And I'm a Jane Austen nut, so I mean, I could do it. But I ran into a dead end. And what happened was there was a scene where a British commander is interviewing this woman with a suspect with a sort of shady past. Mm-hmm. And my intention the entire time was that the chapter would be, I don't know, 5-6 pages, and then the character moves on. But that character speaking went on for 600 pages, you know? And I was like, okay, maybe the book is about her, not everybody else.
And maybe her voice is the language that caught you.
Yeah, because even when I realized that it was a story that's going to be told by a specific character, I still resisted putting it in dialect. Mm-hmm. You know, Huckleberry Finn is one of my favorite novels, mm-hmm. but at the same time, you know, it's not exactly American dialect. You know, there are all sorts of problems. You know, some of my friends in Jamaica are like...
You mean what you're using here?
Yeah.
And so American readers, for example, have to reach into a kind of Jamaican mentality to run with it. Though I didn't find that difficult at all.
No, well, there are certain things that did. For one thing, I didn't spell the words phonetically. If it's, mm-hmm. you know, Jamaicans don't say can't or say can't. Mm-hmm. But if I wrote C-Y-A-A-A-H, you'd Whoa. Be going, what's, I don't up? Understand that. Mm-hmm. So I just left can't, you know, mm-hmm. or we said pon instead of upon, and I just, you know, put an apostrophe, P-O-N, so you would know, oh, it's a pon.
But it's interesting how that use of language does ask the reader to kind of reach out with their mind and imagine a different perspective on the world.
Yeah.
Because a different way of seeing.
Yeah, because you have to... You know, you have to become the character. You have to sort of get in the space of the people who are speaking. It can be, I wasn't interested in a novel where, you know, you are the reader on the outside and the character is on the inside and there is a wall. You have to be mm-hmm. in there.
Take us into that frame, mm-hmm. if you would. I think one important distinction to understand, and you make it very clear, but I wish mm-hmm. you'd kind of outline it, is the difference between slavery and the whole slave society and time in the United States mm-hmm. And in Jamaica. Both had slaves and economies very in the American South and in the Caribbean very dependent on slaves in Jamaica. Mm-hmm. But it's clear that these were different cultures, and I wish you could outline what some of those differences were. I think it helps Americans understand the story you're taking us into here.
Yeah. Well, let me start with one of the similarities. You know, one of the similarities between the American South and the Caribbean, mm-hmm. and to an extent Latin America, and so, which is one of the reasons why we all love Faulkner, is that it was so much of a agricultural, agrarian economy, you know, that was built up almost totally through slavery. Mm-hmm. And when slavery ended, when these economies crashed, Southern society, Caribbean society, all of it kind of crumbled, mm-hmm. and had to rebuild itself. So we all have that in common, which is why I can read The Sound and the Fury, mm-hmm. or, you know, any Southern literature and know the world. That said, while the main difference is that the slave population in the States, as huge as it was, was never larger than the white population. Not even Virginia, that had probably the most slaves. It was still around 10%, 12%. You know, so it was still not, I wouldn't say easy. It wasn't easy, but it was still controllable.
Slaves were only in the most densely enslaved population, 10% of the Americans.
Yeah.
Overall, even in the South.
Even in the South, even in Virginia, that had the most slaves.
While in Jamaica?
While in Jamaica, it was like 98%. You know, there were like 33 slaves for every one white person in the country. You know, so when you have 30 white persons in an estate, that's 300 slaves. So you have that. And also, most of the slaves that tend to come to the States were slaves that were spent some years in the Caribbean, seasoned, they used to call it, and sent to the States.
Terrible word.
Yeah, it's
meaning?
A terrible word. Meaning, you know, you've broken them in, like they're horses or something. Mm-hmm. But in the Caribbean, in Jamaica and other Caribbean territories, they came straight from Africa, you know. And even that notwithstanding, because of the population difference, the masters there had to be even more violent. You know, they were more violent. It was more reckless.
For 1 or 2% of the population to control the 98% slave population,
mm-hmm.
well, you describe it as a society always kind of on the brink of catastrophe.
Yeah,
right? So
it was
volatile,
always.
It could blow up in any direction at any moment.
And it frequently did. Mm-hmm. You know, there was almost always a plot to burn down Kingston, or Montego Bay, I think, got burned down twice.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there was always a rebellion or a plot of a rebellion or rumors of a rebellion. You know, between, say, 1700 and 1830, there was a rebellion or some sort of disturbance almost every year.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you have these things. The British militia has always been shipped to Jamaica. So it was almost as if this sort of permanent state of emergency, you know, all centered around sugar.
And within that state of emergency, this sharply layered society,
mm-hmm.
Within the white society, but also very much within the African, Jamaican, or black society, take us through some of those layers. And first, just broad stroke. I mean, you've got there's some words that may not be familiar in here to some Americans. Maroons,
yeah.
Johnny Jumpers.
Mm-hmm.
Give us a sense of the kind of structure here.
Well, let me go with those who are on the estate, because Maroons weren't on the estate. It's funny. It's another thing that's come on with American slavery, the so-called social divisions, mm-hmm. that happened. There are actually more social divisions in among the slaves than the white population,
mm-hmm.
especially in Jamaica, because there are so few. You could be totally, you know, illiterate in Jamaica and make a lot of money because there's so few of you if you're white.
Mm-hmm.
In Jamaica, you have the house slaves. For one,
mm-hmm.
and the house slaves themselves had divisions. You know, if you were in the kitchen, you probably didn't cook. There was a head house slave. Mm-hmm. Sometimes the head of estates, that person was actually a white person. You know,
mm-hmm.
In a lot of ways, the Irish were the first slaves in the Caribbean.
Irish?
Yeah.
Meaning?
Meaning, you know, there used to be a really, really nasty thing that was said about the Irish in slave societies, that the Irish is just a Negro turned inside out.
Mm.
So, you know, and there's a lot of anti-Irish prejudice in the book, actually.
Among blacks?
The white society.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't just
mm-hmm.
a black-white
mm-hmm.
thing,
mm-hmm.
you know. But to come back to it, so you have the house slaves and the different divisions of house slaves. There's a common perception, even now, that house slaves had it better.
Mm-hmm.
They were the Uncle Toms and so
right.
on, and that's not true. You know, and a house slave could die in a minute. If a house slave prepared dinner and the mistress started coughing, that's a whipping immediately.
And in the book, that's very vivid. I mean,
yeah.
a key character goes from a big fancy dinner party
mm-hmm.
to the most terrible abuse of whipping and rape out in the barn at the hands of white overseers in a nanosecond.
Yeah. And even slaves on the estate who work in the field never knew that house slaves could be subjected to so much brutality. It could be so sudden. Mm-hmm. So that's one myth I think we still have. You know, we talk about, you know, house servants and so on. We still have that myth about them. But then you have the field slaves. And field slaves are divided between those who are the strongest, who could work the hardest, those who are the weakest, who do things like reaping or work the other fields. Even the children had to work, you know, and not just, and they weren't, not, and these slaves weren't just sort of divided in terms of what they can do. Even they had slight prejudices against one another, you know. So even in a society, if you're a freed black person, you consider yourself above. Some of the freed black slaves in here in Jamaica and in the U.S. own slaves. You know, then you have people who are mulattoes or mustis or so on, and they had a whole whole thing. You know, mulatto, slave, white, musti, one-third white, quadroon, one-quarter white.
And then the Maroons, who had freed themselves, became sort of the bounty hunters for new runaways. And the Johnny Jumpers, who sort of, just ran roughshod.
Yeah, the Johnny Jumpers were like black overseers. They were the blacks given whips and put in charge of other blacks. And they were in a lot of ways worse than the white overseers.
Just a world of brutality. We're going to come back to it, get introduced to the main characters in Marlon James' wonderful new book, The Book of Night Women. It's an imagined life in Jamaica, 1800. We'll go out with some, folk music from Jamaica. Very old recording here, Bailo song by the Kumina Singers. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Talking this hour about an imagined life in Jamaica, 1800, in a time of slaves, masters, and revolt, with women at the heart of the rebellion. Marlon James is with us. His powerful new work is The Book of Night Women. I should say you can read an excerpt of the book at our website, onpointradio.org. Marlon James joins me in the studio. Colin McCann reads this book and says it reads like Faulkner in another skin. He's being described as the Juno Diaz or Edgewick Danticat or Zadie Smith of Jamaica, and boy, the book goes a long way to justifying those. it's really something else. Marlon, I wonder if you'd read just a little bit for us.
Sure.
Out of this world, you describe the world of the black man and woman in Jamaica in The Book of Night Women.
Is that from page 11?
Yeah, 11 would be great, yeah.
Okay, let's start. Every Negro walk in a circle. Take that and make of it what you will. A road set before every Negro, from he slip through the slave ship or through birth, that be just as dark, black and long and wide like a thousand year. And when a Negro walk, light get take away from him, so he never know when he hit a curve or a bend. Worse, he never see that he walking round and round and always come back to where he leave first. That be why the Negro not free. He can't walk like a free man, and no matter where he walk, the road take him right back to the chain, the branding iron, the cat o' nine, or the noose. That be the blessing that no Negro woman can curse.
Marlon James, reading from The Book of Night Women. I want to get introduced to some of the main characters in this story, but just to drive home first, what jumps out from this book, and the Chicago Tribune gets at it with this a bright dream of hell here. I mean, this is kind of like wasps in a bottle. Everyone in this society, it's so hard to find anyone to really trust, anyone to really love. It's all against all. It is the kind of nightmare scenario. If I read you right, do you look back and see it in that way? I mean, people are trying for love, they're trying for humanity, but who do you lean on? Who do you trust?
It is, because it's probably the most devastating thing about slavery was the sort of erasing of any form of bond between anybody, whether it was mother, daughter, father, son. That's why, you know, a slave who's born on the estate got sold immediately. You couldn't, you know, there is. The first thing that was destroyed was a whole idea of family and family unit and relationships. And so all of these were fraught. You know, you never could tell for what, you know, What are the risks of falling in love with somebody? You're never going to end up with the person you love. If you do, it's purely to produce children so they can sell them. Or if not, it could be that that person is informing on you. Mm-hmm. So you never know. And so love was almost impossible, but it happened. You know, it's those things had a way of coming through. Sisterhood have had a way of working. You know, one of the ways in which slaves bonded were all these songs, like what we was playing before. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know, all these songs, all these ways of communicating, you know, some of the ways of sending messages where we would in Africa. So all these bonds sort of remained, and it was, you know, it ultimately was sort of indestructible, but not for lack of trying. It wasn't impossible, you know. Even
but it was awfully hard, and you had to be strong, and the darkest sort of abuse and brutality could emerge at just any moment. Maybe you'd read just a little more for us, Marlon, from page 258. There's a picture where the overseer, Jack Wilkins, is just not happy with the attitude of the slaves he's overseeing, and he decides, it seems almost on the spur of the moment, to make an example almost randomly of one young slave girl. Could you read?
Sure. That Saturday in the morning when the woman's washing before they go to the field, Wilkins ride up and grab Leto, a girl who not 16 yet. Leto scream. 1 hour or so later, he summoned all the slaves to one of the empty fields. "This is what happened when you crossed with your master," Jack Wilkins say. In the middle of the field was bundles of stick and bush. In the middle of the bundle was a tree trunk. Tied to the tree trunk was Leto, who screaming, pleading, and crying. Jack Wilkins wave him hand, and a Johnny Jumper come with a burning stick. Behind the Negroes got a sound of click. White slave driver and black slave driver all pointing guns so that nobody can even turn away. The only choice was to close the eye and hear the scream, the likes of which nobody heard before or again. The only choice was to hear the scream and pray she catch fire quick and knock out and wait until the ground's full with the smell of burning Negro. Montpelier niggers behave after that. The estate get good name for having the most docile Negroes, and even the Coromantes learn to be obedient. They behave even after the master die and Jack Wilkins get replaced, and they behave good now with Master Humphrey and Robert Quinn. But some fire don't go out. They go quiet, under the ash, waiting for one little dry stick to feed. So the white man sleep with one eye open, waiting for the fire next time. That fire coming.
Marlon James reading from the Book of Night Women. One young slave girl burnt on top of brush at the trunk of a tree, and the guns go quick so no one can even look away. Mm-hmm. Little references there to Master Humphrey, who came along, the younger new master, and Robert Quinn, an Irish overseer, who plays an important part here. But at the heart of this book are women. One in particular, I wish you'd introduce us to the young slave woman Lilith. And the important women around her who play the night women, who play such a key role here.
You know, I start novels always start with me with characters, and Lilith kind of snuck up. As I was saying before, it wasn't supposed to be her story. She kind of just came in and hijacked the book, and you know, I think it's a good thing at the point where, as a, you know, your characters become so real that you basically become their journalist. You're no longer the author.
Yep.
It's really not your book. And she, you know, she came on as this slave who sort of grew up with a taste of freedom and did not appreciate losing it. You know, she's very feisty. She's very spunky. She's also very, very rude and very, she doesn't take anything from anybody.
But she's in an odd circumstance because her father is this overseer who we just had this other girl burned at the stake, Jack Wilkins.
Yeah.
And the evidence of that is right in her eyes, these bright, vivid green eyes that can only mean a white father.
It can only mean a white father. And, you know, it's sort of an open secret, but it's also kind of an omen. You know, somebody thinks nothing good can come from this. You know, these bright green eyes that sort of look like they shine in the dark. You know, so she has this sort of, you know, darkness, a sort of expectation that's on her, even from she's young. you know, there's this suspicion that she's going to be up to something.
Her father, the overseer, kind of spares her from the worst of it, but only for a while. He takes her off the work cruise until she's a sort of, a young teen.
Yeah, like 14, and he's the same one who sort of banishes her to the field, you know, for whatever his reasons were. And that's the first truly traumatic event in her life. And she lies to escape, you know, into the field. But then that gets her into even more devastating trouble.
One of the Johnny Jumpers, this sort of renegade, black surrogate, overseer, ruthless guys, tries to rape her. She kills him. She ends up in the house. And she ends up in the circle of women. You call them the Night Women.
Yeah.
Introduce us to them. And who are they? What are they up to?
The Night Women are a bunch of field slave, house slaves and field slaves. And for the longest while, they have been plotting a rebellion and been plotting it in secret. You know, the Night Women, in a lot of ways, are sort of a recreation of what would always exist in West Africa, where the power circle is always matriarchal. Mm-hmm. Women decide when to plant crops. Women are the agricultural scientists. Whoever is a king comes from the line of the oldest sister. And they sort of secretly set up this shadow government on the estate. And they wield considerable power. Nobody lives there, nobody dies without their permission, or they have something to do with it. Mm-hmm. And because of what Lilith does, this bloody act, they immediately look at her as a sister. Turns out she really is their sister, but they look at her more as somebody who can join their plans.
Cause they share the same overseer father.
Right. Mm-hmm. But more than that, they've been conspiring to rebel for years now. Mm-hmm. And a couple of the Night Woman, the Head Woman, Homer, all the characters have names from Greek mythology or Greek philosophy. Homer sees this kindred spirit. They talk about this throughout the book, true darkness and true womanness that makes a man scream. And, you know, and they see that in her and think she's the final. She's the linchpin.
What do those mean? They're so key. They're so important. Your true darkness, true womanness.
Because, you know, in you know, I you know, my novel has been called feminist, and it's certainly not a description I run away from. I was seeking to write something that was kind of feminist. Mm-hmm. True womanness in a sense that if you're bad enough that, and the white females show this, by enough that you're defined, you come into a world already defined. Mm-hmm. You know, if you are a white woman, you're already defined in everything from history books to Jane Austen and Jane Eyre as tainted or mad or sort of bestial. So you came in with this baggage thrown on you. If you're a slave, you know, you're considered something just a little bit above a goat. Your sole purpose is working and breeding, you know, and that's not what a woman was. True womanness is whatever you defined yourself to be in there, and that is to be anything or nothing, whatever you choose.
And the Night Women, this circle of women, are determined to achieve that, to nurture it in one another.
Yeah.
To recognize it in one another when the world doesn't.
Right, which is why one of the first things they do is learn to read.
Which is punishable by death in this culture.
Precisely, it's punishable
or
by
slave.
Death. Yeah, it was punishable by death here as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they learn to read. Of course, they're reading what's around them. You know, Vanity Fair, Fanny Hill, you know, Tom Jones.
Henry Fielding, they're reading, but it's what's available.
Yeah. And that also,
and they relate, and Lilith relates. I mean, once she gets it, her eyes are opened as any reader's eyes.
Right. You know, that's a section in the book that's actually, you know, in a lot of ways, the book is about books. Mm-hmm. And Lilith, you know, one gets entranced by Joseph Andrews, the novel, because it's a world she has no experience of, and also it's a world she can escape to. Especially when as her life gets more brutal. But then it also becomes the world that she'll never be a part of, and that sets off another crisis, you know. There's this world where, you know, ladies are ladies and gentlemen are gentlemen, and there's a world she lives in, and she sees nobody like that. Everybody's so brutal, and it's so bloody, and that sets off a crisis.
Marlon James' new book is The Book of Night Women. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. It is brutal, and it is beautiful and powerful at the same time. Marlon, we have a lot of listeners calling in. Mm-hmm. Let's begin to turn to them. From Niagara-on-the-Lake in Canada, Roland is calling. Hi, Roland. You're on the air with Marlon James.
Hi, Roland.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Mr. James.
How are you?
Looking at it, a fascinating subject, and I'm really pleased that you're making it, bringing it alive again.
Mm-hmm.
One of my ancestors, there's a family story at one of my ancestors. We come from the Newcastle area of England.
Yeah.
One of my ancestors went out to Jamaica and was involved in establishing the garrison town of Newcastle in Jamaica, which I'm sure you know about.
I know very well, yeah.
Yeah. So about 20 years ago, I went over to Jamaica and I went to the museum in Spanish Town and I looked at lots of records and poured over things, but I'm afraid I kind of drew a blank, and maybe off air, maybe you could give me your email address, because I'd love to kind of communicate with you, and you're obviously an expert in researching the subject, and I'm a mere amateur, and I'd love to kind of have your help in a sense. Yeah.
We'll have our producer grab you on the way out, Roland, to get that, but let me ask you. I mean, it is anything but a pretty picture of whites who come to Jamaica in this book. The woman Homer, who heads up the Night Women, Marlon James has her say, "What a terrible thing upon this world the white man must be. What a wicked, terrible, brutal creature. Nothing, no wicked like he so." Could that be your ancestor, Roland?
Well, I really hope not. All I can say is my middle name is Gladstone. I was named after the there's great liberal kind of tradition in our family, and I certainly hope not. But the Homer sounds very much like, reminds me of the book by the great Barack Obama that I've just read. The opening pages. One of the janitors said, "You know, why do the whites hate us so much?" And I don't know. It's just very sad, isn't it?
Roland, thank you so much for calling, and leave your contact. I appreciate it. Let's get one from John here, Medford, Massachusetts. John, you're on the air.
Hi, John.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
Yeah, thanks for getting me on.
Yes, you're on with Marlon James.
Can you hear me okay?
Yes, loud and clear.
I was curious, Mr. James, hello, he said, you said that the Irish were the first, the first slaves of Jamaica. I was curious about that because I believe Colin Powell and the guy who wrote The Tipping Point,
Malcolm Gladwell.
Do they have Jamaican roots as well?
They both do. Both have Jamaican parents. Gladwell grew up in Mandeville, which is one of the oldest settlements in Jamaica. There are people in Mandeville. They're like the Mandeville Social Club have been meeting for the past 200 years, and they still do. You know, so they have a very, very strong Jamaican connection.
And what do you make, John, of the Irish connection within that world and time?
Well, I think this is very, very curious. I heard Mr. Gladwell saying that he was raised to the power structure, you know, to be the dominant force by being partially white.
Yeah.
His master, you know, way back, the slave master had a relationship with one of the slave girls. Now Colin Powell comes to the U.S., and he's an African-American.
Mm-hmm.
So, and they're cousins of each other, according to Gladwell.
Yeah.
So it's just the perception of race. I come from Ireland. I came here 23 years ago. I just came back from a trip, brought a little cold with me, and although the weather was good. But I'm always curious about race. I heard you saying, Tom, that your people were indentured servants from Belfast. Was that right, brother?
Oh, wow. You've listened a long time. Yes, yes. Well, it's 1682 or something. Yeah, it's way back. But we never came through Jamaica. John, we'll pick it up after a break here. A lot of race and race mixing, women and rebellion in Marlon James' new book, The Book of Night Women. It is powerful. Here's more traditional Jamaican music, a Jamaican work song, Imo Gal. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about an imagined life. Lives in Jamaica 1800, in a time of slaves, masters, and revolt, with women at the heart of that rebellion. Marlon James is here. His new work is The Book of Night Women. His what the cover here has sort of captures it. It says it's about bondage and freedom, how love subverts one and blindsides The other, about slavery in the West Indies, savage, shocking, and always on the brink of catastrophe. And behind all that, about the irrepressible, ardent, ultimately victorious spirit of freedom. It's quite a book. Marlon, I don't know what thoughts you had on James calling in on Irish ancestry and this mixing of bloods and race and ethnicity is very much at the heart of your story.
It is, and it's very, very, it can be very strange to somebody looking on. The Irish are one of the first indentured servants, that were, sent to the Caribbean, to the Americas, basically.
My own people, as John recalled.
It's called indentured servant. We made no mistake, it was slavery, because it was, they were basically considered the first set to exploit. I think back then, I don't know if they were considered a separate race, but it certainly was people not like the gentry, the planter class, so you have that. You have
but when the mixing came, as in Malcolm Gladwell and Colin Powell and many characters in your book, how was that seen by the by the black slave population? How were they perceived?
It was one of those things that happened all the time but was not really spoken about. In one way, it was kind of sort of unmentionable. But on the other way, there was a huge social status attached to it. A mulatto had a higher social status than, a slave from the slave ship. If you're a quarter black, when you get to the point where you have terms like quadroons and octoroons, you're one-eighth black, one-eighth white.
Gradation upon gradation.
So, yeah, and it creates a social strata that, we sometimes don't like to talk about it, but it kind of still exists.
Was it accidental, as you put your storyline together, that it's these daughters of white overseers who become the plotters of rebellion here? Is it something in their own mixed race that gave them the position or the impulse?
I think, Homer had, the Homer who recruits them, and she's not related to them. Mm-hmm. I think her inner mind, whether she was right or wrong, thought that because of this mixture, they may have a higher taste for blood. Than she's the one who goes on that rant about how terrible the white people are. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So she kind of wants to harness some of that terribleness. And she makes a big mistake there because she's wrong, of course. All the slaves weren't all that good. All the whites in the estate weren't all that bad. So she makes this assumption that there's this sort of wickedness that she's going to harness and turn into serve her own purpose. Of course, it goes terribly wrong because people are just not like that. Mm-hmm. They're complex. They have their good. They have their bad. That was one of the things that was lots of fun, but also very frustrating writing these characters because they became, without my hope, without me even thinking about it, they became all real women, and they all have their own different ideas and their own agendas, and some do have an affinity for the whites that are around them. Mm. Lilith falls for a white overseer, so on.
The Irishman, Robert Quinn.
Yeah.
The brutality is absolutely stark, but yet there's a kind of generosity in this book, if I may call it that, Marlon. Does that come naturally to you? Do you have to stretch to do that? Do you carry any of Homer, the head slave, sort of bitterness in yourself? As a novelist, you must search all this.
Yeah, but if as a novelist, yes. But as a Jamaican, you're kind of both Homer and Quinn.
Mm-hmm.
My mother's name is Dylan, and Dylan and Pratt, which is Irish and Scottish.
Mm-hmm.
My family actually is part of the Pringles, not the very, very rich Pringles. I'd be in much better clothes, but it's so, if I'm going to trace my family back, we're on the side of the masters, not the slaves.
But as you walk through the world in American terms, you've got your dreads and your dark-toned skin. Does it leave you choosing sides or just feeling empathy for all sides here?
You sort of leave it an empathy for all sides. Mm-hmm. In the States, I think it's easier to sort of pick a side. It's not that easy in Jamaica because of all that mixing and so on that went on. Mm-hmm. And it creates a society, which is not to say that we're so over race. We're not at all. We have our issues as well. It just plays out in a different way. We may not have Jim Crow, but it probably was centuries before the Jamaica Club letting anybody who was even light-skinned, you know, much less white. There are still parties in Jamaica where you won't see a black person. So it's still it's still there in some ways. And one of the reasons why I did write this book is a lot of the some of the reality of it still exists, where you have on one side all this mixing, all these wonderfully, you know, mixed and racially diverse people, but you still have a lot of the same racial attitudes. We don't talk about it, which is, you know, things like, you know, lightening one's race to pass. My family did that. You know, my family actually has been feuding for nearly 200 years because there's a side of my family that was on this program, must always get lighter, marry somebody lighter.
So it's lineage you're talking about. It's a genetic project.
And my great-grandfather married a darker-skinned woman. And he basically, you know, messed with the plan. You know, we're supposed to be moving. And it caused a feud. The first time, we're actually still split. We have the Eastern Jameses and the Western Jameses. I'm an Eastern James. And the first time I met a Western James was my grandmother's funeral.
That's a deep split.
Yeah, they came to the funeral, they sat in the front, and they left. They didn't go to the cemetery, anything.
And these were the lighter skinned Jameses.
Right. I was like, who are those people? I said, those are the Western Jameses. Wow. Like, whoa. So it's still, we like to think those things don't happen, but we're still feuding.
It's a rich, rich story. Let's get more of it. Barbara is calling from Newton, Massachusetts. Barbara, you're on the air.
Hi, Barbara.
Yeah, hi. Hi, Tom. It's Barbara Howard. I do the breaks for you from time to time.
Oh, yes. Hi. Great to have you.
And, as you know, my mother is from Kingston. Mr. James, she's a Woolmer's girl.
I'm a Woolmer's boy.
Yeah, okay then. It's a very good school in Kingston. I grew up with these kinds of stories, and it's hard to talk about slavery in Jamaica without talking about the cockpit country, the Jamaican balloons. This history of the interior of Jamaica, where the slaves went up and escaped and lived in the interior, these conical, misty, very magical-looking mountains, they, from time to time, would come down and raid the coastal sugar plantations.
Yes, that's
and
true.
And essentially, from what I understand from hearing from my mother, was that the government, the Jamaican government, the white run government, made a deal with these escaped slaves that essentially they'd have autonomy if they lived in the interior. They'd give them total autonomy. This is hundreds of years ago.
1720s.
In exchange for leaving them alone on the coastal plantations. And up in the interior, if you look at a Jamaican map, you'll see the cockpit country. I remember as a young child looking at the roads that were uncharted. The roads would go up into the cockpit country and abruptly end because no one had ever charted it. It's really rough up there. There are towns called, like, Minosen Yunokum.
Yes.
There's towns like...
It's still there. Wait a bit.
Yes. Yeah, it's called the District of Look Behind.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the slaves were looking over their shoulder, making sure they weren't being chased, and the white guys were looking over theirs to make sure they weren't getting...
But, you know, Barbara, as Marlon James tells the story of the Maroons up in those central mountains of Jamaica, it's not quite so benign in Marlon's telling.
Yeah, it doesn't come off...
There's another part of the deal you didn't mention, which you make quite a bit of, Marlon, that they, part of their agreement was that they would also become part of the...
Yeah, the slave capture effort. You know, partly that's because we have a sort of very troubled, ambivalent relationship with the Maroons, and everything that Barbara says is true. They became their own, basically their own city states. In fact, they have their own government even now. But one of the terms of these treaties was that they would then, from now on, turn in any slave that ran to the mountains.
The Maroons would, even though they were free themselves.
Right. Mm-hmm. They're turning slaves. What happened is they also got very good at this. So they would start to then hunt slaves down and return them. It became a thing. You were paid £2 for every slave. That's a lot of money in 1785. £2 is major money. So they became almost professional slave hunters. You know, and it's also it's part of the history. You know, you can't take the good with the bad, and so in some ways they're looked upon as the even before Haiti, the first real African city states and the first self-determined, self-governed, you know, people, the first people who brought the British to their knees. But they also looked upon as people who betrayed their fellow people.
Barbara, what attitude has your mother passed to you about this slave history in Jamaica?
Well, you know, she was raised there and came back to the States. So my orientation is, of course, being raised, as you know, you're from Illinois. I'm from Missouri. My father's company moved us there. And as a child, I remember she didn't really tell us much of this history and chose to have us keep it to ourselves because back when I was a child living in Missouri, there were laws against intermarriage, and my mother, who looks white, although her mother is black, married my father, and because of that, the situation in Missouri would have been, as a child, I would have been considered, pardon the expression, but a bastard. So she was very worried about that, and a lot of this history, because the United States still had those laws on the books until the Supreme Court reversed them in, I believe it was 67, you know, that was a very much a worry for her, and you know, it's definitely informed her life all along.
Barbara, you remind us of just how real and current and ongoing this history is. And I thank you very much for calling in. Let me get another here, if I may, from Springfield, Massachusetts. Paul, you're on the air.
Hey, hello, George. How are you?
Marlon.
Yes. Hey, Marlon. Here we go. Hey, Marlon.
Paul's there. Okay.
Paul.
Got that sorted out. Paul. What do you know, Paul?
Okay. You, bro. This program got me sweating, okay? I know, for real, because I'm a Jamaican, okay? I've been in the States for 30 years.
Where in Jamaica are you from?
I'm from Kingston.
Ah, me too.
Okay. Ever since I've been here, I've been trying to enlighten black Americans about the history of Jamaica and where we're coming from, because they had the feelings that they were the only one that was going through this, okay? And trying to enlighten them and trying to make the connection between, you know, how is slavery and how part of it came over here. And, you know, we all intertwine in together with this. And another thing I'd like to point out is that that's where we got our motto from, out of many one people.
Jamaica's motto.
Yes, Jamaican's motto.
Yeah.
And that's where, because of we came out of that, you know, mixed breed, we put that motto together. But we do have our martyrs that we, you know, we still look upon, like George William Gordon. And Paul Bogle, and all those guys that fought all those great rebellions.
Yeah, well, they were after slavery, but Sam Sharp was the 1831 rebellion. You know, let me say one thing about, you know, because they're for a while, and there's always sometimes this tension between North Americans and people from the Caribbean, and as if, you know, and on one hand, we're both guilty on both sides of not understanding where we're coming from. But at the other hand, you know, we as Jamaicans sometimes forget that, you know, North Americans recognized Marcus Garvey first.
Marcus, you know, Garvey, yes.
You know, that they recognize that a crucial part of the Harlem Renaissance was Claude McKay. You know, Zora Neale Hurston did a lot of field work in Jamaica. So there's always this search for a connection that we keep forgetting, you know.
Paul, thank you for your call. Marlon, our time grows short, and there's so much more to say. I don't want to miss the chance to hear you on this subject, because you, again, in the context of such brutality, you insist on seeing the humanity in all the characters in this book, and this notion of bondage and freedom, how love subverts one and blindsides the other. Say more on that.
You know, at the core of the novel is a love story, and that was a shock to me, actually, and I really fought against it.
And it's a white, black, or white mulatto love story.
Yeah, I really fought against it, largely because I just thought it would undercut the brutality, actually. And I thought, you know, and also thought, you know, I'm a literary fiction writer. I don't do love. You know, no.
Schmaltzy love.
Yeah, I don't do love. And, you know, a friend of mine who's Irish actually said, you know, you need to risk sentimentality, you know, which is a great thing to say, but it's, you don't want to hear
as
that.
As a foil against the brutality, or because it's real?
It's real, and because these things, it happened, and I was being, I was being sort of intellectually dishonest by just having all these white characters as monsters. And also, the fact that even now you'll come across a light-skinned, a mixed-race person in Jamaica is not always rape. Sometimes it was love. Sometimes it was defiant love. Sometimes these people became, you know, fine. Nobody would marry them, but they were married in every sense of the word. It happened more often than people think. You know, just because, you know, the person beside me is lighter-skinned doesn't mean somebody got raped in a slave ship. sometime. Yes, it did happen, but it's not, isn't always that. And I wanted to show, you know, even at the risk of, you know, sort of turning off people who came to expect a hate-filled rant for 400 pages, that even in, you know, even in such absolutely horrendous odds that, you know, love was possible, relationships happen. Some of these relationships between Master and Overseer went until one of them died of old age, you know, and I wanted to certainly capture that. I also wanted people to come to terms with that. Even these two, Master, Overseer and Slave, had things in common. If nothing else, both were looked down upon by the gentry at the time, you know, and both kind of sort of resist the whole idea of being better people, you know.
It's a marvelous, moving, rough, and tender book at the same time, like life itself, maybe life then in particular. No small debt to Toni Morrison and our friend Alice Walker in this book, Marlon James, which you acknowledge very freely, and a kind of a tradition, if I can use that word, that you that you tap into or move on wonderfully. Marlon James' new work is The Book of Night Women. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Mr. James, thank you very much for the book, and thanks for coming in today.
Thanks for having me.
We'll go out with a little more traditional music from Kamina Singer's country song from Jamaica. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.